me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Joe Kirk and Phil Brynan. Hello, both of you.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
So this week's session was GDPR radio. So we spoke about loads of, in the news and really had some really good conversation and covered a lot of ground. There's been loads in the news recently, hasn't there?
Absolutely tons. Yeah. Tons, Joe, isn't there?
Yeah, there's every week there seems to be a new breach, and specifically police forces within the UK. So there's been a new one from the Metropolitan Police Service, and we sat and spoke about that, didn't we, for about 15 minutes. Actually, it took up quite a bit of a chunk, but it's so vital, isn't it, that we talk about these things, because you know, they're a real issue to the members of the police force. So yeah, it was.
I think it really drives home the importance of data protection, you know, to people that aren't involved in it day to day as well. It's these real life examples that are real risks, and, you know, people can see the actual effects of not taking it seriously or not having sufficient measures in place, and, you know, everything that comes with it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the thing about the Met breach led us into talking about, you know, suppliers again and due diligence again, you know, because it was a supplier, you know, one of their processes that actually got breached. And that led us to talk about Cloud Nordic, who've, you know, a cloud provider, have lost all their customers' data through a ransomware attack. And then, you know, we talked about a few other breaches. So, you know, we had a lot of probably 25 minutes talking about breaches and hacks and, you know, and then, you know, the Fire Stick hack. I mean, that was beggared belief, didn't it, that one?
Yeah, I'm impressed, to be honest.
But the bit that I liked, which was going to be my kind of my feature story, if you like, was the Airbnb. And I think this is just again really resonated with me, because a lot of the customers that I work with are using ID verification. And the ruling by the Irish Data Protection Commissioner, I know it's Ireland and I know it's not the UK and the ICO, but just the way that they've structured their thought process, their logic, challenging legitimate interest, challenging retention, challenging data minimization, challenging transparency. Again, I took a lot out of reading through that transcript of their judgment, and I wanted to talk about it on this, because I think a lot of our customers are using ID verification and they need to think about it, and they need to read this stuff, and they need to think about it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, I think from what I read, I mostly agree with what was said, but it's something that I wouldn't have thought about in this context in the past, and that's the most important bit for me is you know, applying it to ID verification and taking that with you, and, you know, wherever else you go, for us, that's advising other customers.
Exactly, yeah. So what was your favourite bit, Joe, your bit you'd highlight to people?
I did enjoy the hacking stuff at the start, but I did mention about halfway through dinner that the ICO and the CMA have released a joint paper on online choice architecture. So, yeah, listen out for that about halfway through.
Yeah, all right, perfect.
Yeah, for me, you kept me waiting. It was the little piece on AI at the end, because it's, you know, there's still so many questions around AI and when you know, when it applies to data protection legislation and so on. So we had a little chat about that, but there'll be a main session to follow at some point. But yeah, for now, we hope you enjoy the session. If you've got any feedback on what you'd like us to cover in a session, just drop us an email. But yeah, enjoy.
So if you have any objections to that, then let us know after the session. We do put them out on platforms like Spotify and Apple Music and others. And the privacy notice is there, so you can see, you know, what we're doing it for. It's really just for the community's benefit. That's the only thing we use these things for. So what kind of a week have you had then, Joe and Jasmine?
My week's been a little short, because obviously it was a bank holiday Monday. Me and Jasmine actually went to Leeds Carnival, which was very fun. And then I was off Tuesday as well, so it's been a shorter week for me, so it's been quite nice. But I've just been doing lots of data protection risk assessments for one of our customers, which is always exciting.
Very good. And what have you been up to, Jasmine, in your 4 days?
Well, mine was actually three as well, because I think I caught something at Carnival.
Right.
Okay. Partly recovery, and also it's the end of the financial month, so it's been very sales focused, but still SARS are just, you know, chipping away at my sanity. So.
Right. Right. Oh, very How about good. You? I was just checking my diary. I thought, I can't remember, but I was in London yesterday, which was really good. I wrote up my audit report from the audit I did a couple of weeks ago, got that finished off, which is really good, actually. I'm hoping that that's a really good help to the customer. I did quite a detailed look. I mean, they had pretty much something in every area, but gaps in every area as well. So, and some bits were completely out of control, like processes, you know, the process contracts had tons missing and kept referring to PII, you know, rather than personal data. So, and bits of it were not good enough, but most of it was there or thereabouts. So with a bit of remediation, I think they'll be in a really good, strong position to be able to demonstrate compliance in pretty much every area. I mean, everyone's got tricky bits with the international transfers at the moment, you know, and retention's a challenge. But this company actually has a really good retention approach in place. And most of them business model is as a processor. So they don't do much as a controller, but their entire business model is working as a processor. But anyway, I got that done. And then I had a really good day in London yesterday with Dave. We went down to see, you know, Gary Shipsey, a really good data protection practitioner. You had a firm called Protector. So we had a catch up with Gary. And then a cyber consultant who's absolutely amazing, Anna. You'll have heard of Anna. She runs Anna Consultancy. And she's really, really good. So we had a cup of tea with her as well. And then it was back on the trains, which got delayed and cancelled and so on and so forth. But that's... that's been the week. But there's been a lot in the news, hasn't there, this week?
Yeah, there has. A lot around breaches and hacking and so on. I think we've all noticed a bit of that, especially the Metropolitan Police breach. Have you seen that?
Yeah, have I? I thought it was reading double. I somehow mistook Metropolitan Police for public, you know, the Northern Ireland Police Service. So I thought, I haven't. This is a new one.
It's a common theme, isn't it, at the minute?
Yeah, it is. What have you? Are you across this one, Joe?
I've had a read of it this morning. I've had a read of it this morning. It's not good, is it? To put it lightly.
It's not good. But I mean, you know, I think we have to put it into some. Well, I don't know if we have to or not, but put it into some context. It's a processor that's let them down, isn't it? So, you know, one of their suppliers has had their system hacked. They supply warrant cards. And I think warrant cards are the badges, aren't they, that, you know, that the police get issued. So, you know, conceivably someone could be producing rogue warrant cards potentially, you know, as well as getting the data of the acting officers.
So the supplier had the data of the names, the ranks, the photos, the vetting levels. I'm not sure what vetting levels are, you know, if you can.
That'd be their security levels, won't it? You know,
and the pay numbers for officers and staff. So it's not nothing too sensitive in there.
Well, I think it's a bit like this Northern Ireland, you know, that you've got names and ranks and numbers and, you know, information about all the serving officers in the Met, which is a big police force, and also in a it's not, you know, it's a metropolitan, big eight metropolitan area, isn't it?
It's not so much as well the data, it's the context around the data, you know, whose hands that could fall into and the risks associated with that. I think, you know, one of the differences with this is that it's full names and photos that have been included. So these people, these police officers, they can be identified and are probably a lot easier than those in the Northern Ireland service as well. So it can be, you know, it can be a worrying time for them.
Yeah, but it made me think, well, if you can extract data out of systems, presumably you can insert data into systems. So, you know, you could actually make up fictitious officers and give them some credentials and, you know, get a staff pass to get you into buildings and potentially secure areas, or warrant cards. So I was wondering about it being a two-way street. You know, you guess you can get data out, but presumably you can put data in as well.
Yeah, I thought about that.
Potential of forgery, isn't there, as well, like you said, of them making one for themselves and then going into the Metropolitan Police Service, the, you know, the main headquarters, I guess. And do you think they'll be able to get access? I don't know how the would there be chips in the cards? I don't know, but
who knows?
Potential, right? I mean, I've seen videos of not people going into the Metropolitan Police Service, but people getting into places they shouldn't be just by putting on a high vis jacket and a lanyard and just walking in. And, you know, it's quite a concern, isn't it, that someone's got that information out there. And I'm sure there's people out there that could forge, you know, very good replicas of the warrant cards. So, it's not good. But then, you like you say, it was the supplier, wasn't it? It wasn't actually Metropolitan Police. Well, so this comes down to the old age question of, well, point of that due diligence is so important, isn't it, when engaging with these suppliers?
Absolutely right, Jill. I think I hit the nail on the head. Now, Fiona's saying that she used to work at the Met and she'd be checking if her old warrant card was affected. You know, it could just former staff as well as currently serving staff, I suppose. But you're right, Joe. It's that supply chain. It's that due diligence, isn't it? You know, have to have some sympathy for the Met that, you know, they can't do everything themselves. I was asked to write an article, comment on this, and I was like, well, you can't do everything yourself. You have to contract out personnel. As soon as you start processing anything, you're gonna have to accept there's a risk associated with that. But what due diligence did they do, you know, on the supplier? And how long has the supplier been in post? And, you know, sometimes I think there's a danger of doing due diligence as a start of the relationship and then doing nothing else, you know. And I think monitoring in our data protection, in our processes, standard operating procedure, our templated one, there's a section that says something like, you know, ongoing management of processes, and it's completely blank. And everyone says, oh, you know, why is it all blank? Let's take it out. But, you know, you've got to determine what you're going to do in running to keep that processor on their toes, whether it's auditing them or whatever it is. But that is some area that sometimes is missing, I think.
Yeah, I don't think you see that a lot. I mean, you know, it's good going to first have due diligence on all of your suppliers, you know, for a lot of organisations as it is. There's a lot of times where we'll be helping organisations retrospectively make sure that they've done them checks. Yeah. And I guess with that, you know, in mind, at least then that will be an up-to-date check. So there are positives, even though it's, you know, a bit inadvertent. But
yeah,
I think it's the level of due diligence. It comes down to that question again of what do you do and what is sufficient. Is, you know, we've got a due diligence questionnaire. Is that overkill for some? Is it enough for others? It's
horses
weighing
for
it
courses,
up and,
isn't it? It's horses for courses. Yeah. What so did you mention earlier on, maybe before the call, about South Yorkshire Police have referred itself to the
I read this. So they've noticed a significant and unexplained reduction in data stored on its systems. So the force said it's urgently working with experts to recover footage filmed by officers as they attended incidents or engaged with the public, which in some cases could be used as evidence in court. So it's a bit of a concern. Yeah.
How the hell does that happen?
Well, it could be a SharePoint, really. Don't you get? I get frequent. I'm recording this, right? I initiated the recording, but in 6 months' time, I'm going to get an automatic message saying it's been deleted. Because it does do that, doesn't it?
Yeah, systematic deleting, where it just automatically reaches the retention period of whatever database it's on if they're using something
potentially
external.
Potentially.
I know, but in this case, it's an unexplained reduction now. Which
yes, it's true.
Bit,
good point. Good point. Cynical. Now, what do you think of, you know, so the ITO has made a public statement that for the next, I think, 2 years, including the 2 years and this year, they're not going to issue fines, monetary penalty notices to public authorities in the main. So what do you think that has any impact on? I'm not sure it does, but do you think that has any impact on, you know, the extent to which, you know, public sector, you know, carry out due diligence, and, you know, if there was fines at the end of the process, would that change anything? I don't think it would do with processes, would it?
I feel like there's a lot to unpick in this. So, you know,
that's why I asked you the question.
let me speak as I'm thinking, and then I'll get around to it. But I think, you know, monetary penalty notices, I don't think is the most effective way, but at the same time, it does, you know, ignite some fear or fire to, you know, make sure that your processes are in place. I think it's probably counterproductive for public services, but there do need to be measures in place that push authorities to make sure that they've got, you know, that they're compliant and that they're doing everything that they should be, that they've got everything in place, including checks, periodic checks on these things. So
there has to be something else that holds them accountable, though, doesn't it? If you're not going to fine them, fine, but you have to do something. You can't just let them be, because it's clearly an issue, because it's in the news every week at the minute, isn't it, with a different police force coming up with a breach.
Yeah.
So that they have to do something. You can't just sit here and just say, oh, we're not going to find you, we're going to give you a slap on the wrist and let you get on with it, because that's no good to anybody, is it?
I think they need to take a different approach to it, in a way that they're not firefighting, they're not looking at these authorities and organizations after something's occurred. They need to get ahead of the game. I was thinking earlier, in I guess schools and education, they're regulated or audited by Ofsted. So they'll get regular checks to make sure that they've what they've got in place, if it's sufficient, what the results are of this and so on. If there was a similar approach to public authorities, that might be an effective way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I read a very interesting article about the kind of reprimand approach, because it's not really mentioned in the GDPR to any great extent. It's mentioned but not expanded upon in the recitals. And apparently, which I didn't really realise this until I read the article and looked into it, that there's no right of appeal on a reprimand. So, you could suffer reputational damage because you've had a reprimand for some misdemeanour, but you've got no grounds to go back and challenge that, whereas with the monetary penalty notice is a formal structure to it. So this article was saying the ICO has issued no guidance on reprimand only or reprimands. Some reprimands are in the public domain and they're written letters that are signed, and some aren't, and they're just like documents. So there's no structure to it. The ICO need to really get on top of this if they're going to use it as a mechanism and get some better structure around it. Which is quite interesting, just kind of think it through in those terms. Now, I think
that again, though, it highlights how the effect of a reprimand compared to a monetary penalty notice, they're not really equivalent in that sense. So, needs to be more.
Yeah, I get it with the monetary penalty notices. It's recycling public funds. It's not coming out of shareholders' pockets. It's coming out of the public the public, the taxpayers' pockets. So, maybe we haven't found the perfect solution. Yeah, maybe you've got some good ideas that you've raised, Jasmine. Now, there's been other hacks this week as well. I read, I don't know if you've seen any others, but there's a couple I want to talk about. There's other things we want to talk about today other than hacks. There's some fantastic stuff about identity verification, a case in Ireland, which I really want to explore today, because I think that's very relevant to a lot of organizations that do that, whether it's employees or customers. So we're going to come on to some other stuff. But did you see that there was a cloud hosting provider in Denmark that have lost everything, all the data of all their customers? So they got a ransomware attack. They were moving some servers around. They think a vulnerability was triggered. They're called Cloud Nordic. And then the ransomware has basically encrypted all of the hard disk, all of the data on all of their servers for all of their customers.
Oh, my God.
I'm sure that's what they said as well. Now, they've only been charged. This is bizarre, really, because they've been asked for 6 bitcoins as a ransom payment, which apparently is, according to the PC magazine, it's $160,000, which isn't a massive amount, is it? Anyway, the Cloud Nordic have refused to pay it, but they're trying to rebuild everything. And one of the executives who was interviewed says, didn't expect there'll be any customers left when they actually get round to finishing off the build. It was a bizarre one, I thought. But that's the vulnerability of you've got your supply chain, everyone's in the cloud. If Salesforce gets taken out, wow, what a problem.
For us as well.
Well, yeah, but we're at that 200,000 organizations, including governments, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I saw as well, go on, carry on.
I was going to say, are you aware of the amount of people that use Cloud Nordic? Is it a big cloud company, is it, or is it just...
No, not at all. But apparently there's a sister company called Zero Cloud, AZERO Cloud, that suffered the same attack and has issued the same kind of public notice. So there was two attacks of the same kind of company. So I don't know how many customers it had. I don't know if they're a big player or a little player. But it just goes to show, though, you are doing your due diligence on your processor. You think they're a cloud company that's well-established, well-set-up, and bang, Anyway. I also saw something really interesting. A few years ago, I don't know if you remember, there was a casino that got its databases hacked through its fish tank. It had a smart thermometer in its fish tank. Hackers used that to access the corporate network it sat on, and they hacked their way all the way through to the customer databases.
No way.
Yeah. Anyway, I was reminded of that because there was a British teenager from Oxford who's been arrested again for hacking into Rockstar Games, who do Grand Theft Auto, and he stole code to GTA 6, and he's published it out on some sites, and he's holding them to ransom. And he actually was on bail when he did this, and being held in a travel lodge, and was banned from having any computer devices. So how did he do it? It's like one of those Death in Paradise things, you know.
I've seen the story, so I know the answer.
Of all things to compare it to.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Are you going to punchline Joe?
Yeah, he went to, did he go to the Argos, did he, next door or something, and bought an Amazon Fire Stick?
Yeah.
And then accessed a cloud through that or something. And remarkable. And how do you even know how to do that?
Well, because he's a hacker. He spun up a virtual Linux environment in a cloud environment and then used that to get into Rockstar Games services, and then got hold of some footage. The game's not even been released yet, I believe. And then got on their company's Slack messaging system, which is meant to be secure, and said, I'm not a Rockstar employee, I'm an attacker, and I've got all this stuff with a fire stick.
That sounds a bit like, do you remember that Uber breach? Was it the beginning of this year or last year, where that teenager, I think he accessed Uber's Slack system and then started threatening them, saying that he's an 18-year-old and he's going to do this and do that. Do you remember it?
I do remember us talking about it, but I don't remember the detail of it.
Yeah. It just reminds me of that. I think these people need hiring, to be honest.
I think it's going to be a problem for a lot of organisations, isn't it, moving forward? I don't really know how you put a wrap on these sort of things, but I mean, if someone can do that with a fire stick, you know, who knows what they can do when they've got, you know, great software on.
I've got an apricot sat on my desk here.
I don't think that'll do much.
I don't know.
Yeah, who knows? But, you know, talking about that breach, I remember when that actually happened, because I was on Twitter, actually, of all places, and Twitter couldn't believe it, that it'd been leaked on there. And because GTA 5 is 10 years old, everyone thought the game would be a lot further in terms of progression, but it was terrible, the quality of the game. I know that's not really the point of the story, but yeah, it couldn't have done any good to Rockstar as a company is the point I'm getting at, really, because everyone couldn't believe, you know, how poor the game was, I guess.
Maybe that's why I did. I don't think it is, but it's interesting. And I also read something about this was just kind of Microsoft have advised or released a report saying that, you know, there's risks around large sporting events, cyber risks around large sporting events, which probably is quite obvious, but it just got me thinking about, you know, where those risks might be, you know. So, you know, you've got that the fan base, you know, the fan databases with potentially financial information, profile information, you know, away travel information for ease of robbing people's homes, that type of stuff. But, you know, actually on the day, though, you've got, you know, potentially row tickets being issued. You've got the turnstiles, which are really simple. They have a whitelist and a blacklist, you know, and if you're on the whitelist, you're in, and if you're on the blacklist, you're not in, you know. But if you get into the systems and insert new records into the ticketing system or the whitelist on the turnstile, then you're in, you know, if you've got a token to get in with. Advertising board messages could get hacked, payment systems in concourses or retail outlets. What about the heating ventilation systems, pitch heating system, the aircon, the lighting, the floodlights, you know, access control systems, scoreboards, betting, live feeds, website, commentaries? I mean, if you think about, you know, a large sporting event, you know, there's so many opportunities for cyber. Anyway, this quite interesting report just about Microsoft highlighting that there are risks there.
I wonder how many of them go unnoticed as well. You know, during these sporting events, because I think a lot of these sporting events, you know, they're temporary events, aren't they? So it's I don't know if the measures around that and the checks around that will also, I guess, match that. So
In the time I worked in professional sport, when I started working at Leeds United 20 years ago or 25 years ago, all the advertising boards around the pitch were literally planks of wood that got painted with a logo on it by a sign writer. He came in for like 2 or 3 weeks and he painted all the signs and they got plonked around the pitch. And then we invested in a new system, which was vinyl banners, and they rotated round, you know, the computer controlled. But then they frequently failed. It was a fairly new system. So then I was always terrified that, you know, because I was in commercial director, you know, if the if the advertising boards fell, I've got my sponsor on my back saying, you know, what's going on? I didn't get all my minutes. And then we moved on to LED boards, which were equally unreliable at first, where you've got the, you know, which you've got now, isn't it? You've got moving ads, you know, and you've got, so yeah, it's moved on quite a lot in the last 25 years.
But the problem with that, with the attacks at football games, if they did manage to get into the turnstile systems, that could cause a real issue, couldn't it, for the health and safety of the
public
people?
Order.
That
are, yeah.
Because think about how many people are there drinking, quite a lot, right? Drinking, and you're impatient to get inside, and there could be a crush, couldn't there, if the turnstiles just all of a sudden stopped working and there was thousands of people in such a small space. So,
well, there's numerous occasions.
It's a real
Joe.
Concern.
Yeah, numerous occasions, well, not many occasions, but a few occasions I can remember, both at Leeds and at Everton, where just before kickoff, you know, there's a massive surge of people and you have to let them through. You cannot keep checking the tickets because it's it's a public order event. And the police are in charge, you know, of that, you know, they will make the decision whether to, what to do.
Good to know, though.
Yeah, get all your mates to get the jazz and pile up at that last minute.
Straight before the game.
Get 500 of you to just run up,
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you saw that the ICO has issued some guidance. I mean, this may had me a little bit perplexed to start with. You know, they said, take care when copying people into emails using BCC. And I thought, what? What's all that about? So I read on with the article and I thought, well, you know, BCC has been one of those things that we're encouraged to do. But apparently, you know, the risk is, and I guess it's obvious again when you think about it, that, you know, if you reply all to BCC, then you might be sending something out to people you don't even know are on the recipient list to start with. And I didn't know that happened. I didn't know if you did a reply all, it might pick up people
right,
you
so
couldn't
if,
see on the.
So if Jasmine emailed me and blind copied you in, and then I replied all, and I didn't realise you were there, you'd get the email back.
I don't know.
Well,
we need to test it, but this what this thing says that I read.
So the lesson there is just to press reply as opposed to reply all.
Just be aware. Yeah. They're saying actually don't do that. You know, don't use BCC. They're saying use a proper email system. You know, use mail merge or bulk email services or secure data transfer services. They're saying, you know, try not to use BCC because it could have risks associated with it.
But then there's risks if you, is mail merge not done through a different software? Is it through like Microsoft? Is it or is it through? Is
it could be. You could use your contact database and merge it into Outlook, but then each person gets a unique email rather than it being one email with everyone on the copy list. Again, interesting stuff. You know, interesting stuff. You read this stuff, you think, right, okay, that's something else I didn't know. That's you know.
I think I think the biggest issue though with people copying emails is putting the wrong person in the copied email. I think that's the biggest concern as opposed to blind copying.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. So yes, quite a few hacks and breaches this week, which you know, quite depressing, but it is just the way of the world, I think, isn't it?
At the moment, definitely.
Now, one of the things I absolutely desperately want to talk about today, which is why I'm trying to keep talking, Jasmine, before you dive in with AI, is that
I'm just letting you talk, Phil. I don't know how many cups of coffee you've had, but I can't get in anyway.
No, do please.
I'm joking.
This is something that I'm hoping will resonate with people and that they'll sort of the chat will light up. But Airbnb were reprimanded by the Irish Data Protection Commissioner. They had a complaint, basically, somebody had made that Airbnb asked them for photo ID to verify that they were who they said they were. And they challenged it. And the Data Protection Commissioner has had a look at this. And they've had a look at two or three different aspects, which I think, again, this is really good stuff for us to know about. So they initially looked at the lawful basis for processing, which Airbnb said was a legitimate interest. And if you read, I put the copy, unless you can copy and stick it in the chat here.
The actual thing itself.
Yeah, the actual thing itself. So again,
I'll stick it in.
Multi-page document, quite interesting. We've put we know which paragraphs reference all the relevant stuff to read rather than flying through it. But anyway, Airbnb said that the legitimate interest was their lawful basis processing. And after a lot of deliberation, the Data Protection Commissioner agreed with them. Okay. But they implied in that agreement that in these specific circumstances, that legitimate interest was appropriate. because if you got somebody move, you know, going into somebody else's house and they need to know that they're safe. Now, the implication is that can you still apply the legitimate interest in a workplace context or in other contexts where it's not quite such high stakes? Again, I think we need to think about that because.
Well, sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say, because we absolutely must have to do an LIA and a DPIA just to substantiate the decision making we've been through.
Yeah, me and Jasmine were talking about this before, you know, earlier on this morning, and we couldn't quite understand why legitimate interest was the chosen lawful basis, because if it's in the terms of the, you know, between Airbnb and the user and the host, you know, that part of the onboarding process, I guess you call it, is that, you know, that we're going to take ID verification from you. Could you not rely on performance of a contract as a lawful basis?
Well, they didn't go into that, Joe. Maybe if Airbnb had said it's a performance of a contract, then they might have explored that. But, you know, why I'm raising this is because we know that a lot of our customers do ID verification, and we do it with SARS, don't we? And the lawful basis for that is more likely to be, you know, a legitimate interest. I would suggest what I'm saying is that the ICO, the DPC, has turned that over and had a look at it and said this is what they think are not exceptional but specific circumstances, where what they're saying is that there's a service in the real world, not the cyber world, and therefore the risks are higher, and therefore legitimacy of the legitimate interest is more substantial,
right?
So that was one of the things I looked at. Then the second thing they looked at was minimization. So the complainant had said that photographic ID was not essential and ID verification could have been undertaken in a different way. Again, the Data Protection Commissioner looked at that and said, well, actually, in this particular case, you did try and go down a different route for ID verification, but it didn't work. So we requested photographic ID. And again, the Data Protection Commissioner said that in this particular circumstance, because of all of that background, that they didn't think that the request for photographic ID infringed the minimization principle. Again, by implication, if you don't ask and provide alternative means for ID verification, you may be thought to be infringing the minimization principle. So again, how many of our customers do that? You know, how many of our customers, you know, don't have alternative methods of ID verification and just rely on, I want a driving license or a passport, I want a government issued photo ID. Food for thought.
In my head, I compare this to staying at a hotel. So I reckon there's further risk with, you know, Airbnb, because someone's putting out their home. You know, it's very much more. Like on an individual basis rather than, you know, a big corporate basis, where it's more secure. It's just more secure in general. You know, you might even have CCTV in the hotel and things like that, just for various reasons. Yeah. So in hotels, you know, maybe abroad you need to provide your passport, but it doesn't happen so much in this country. So I think if they were to broaden this, you know, people might take that to mean, you know, in hotels this also applies, where it might not necessarily.
I think it's a good point. So that's really why they were saying that the controller's legitimate interests were kind of quite compelling, because of the real risk you got a one-on-one or maybe a many-to-one relationship inside of the house. You know, you come up with your gang of mates, you know, on a weekend, and there's one person in that house, you know. So That's what they were saying. Mm. And then the two other areas that they talked about was transparency, and they turned over the Airbnb privacy policy, and actually they said it did agree with the principle of transparency, but then they looked at retention, and you know they were saying, and if you read the link that Joe's put in place, they're saying that this breach is ongoing, this breach of the regulations is ongoing, so they want it fixing. So Airbnb retain the ID verification documents as a matter of policy, as long as the user has an account. And the Data Protection Commission said it don't agree with that at all. And this is where, again, I think we need to be mindful of. So they said that once the ID verification had been completed, then you don't need the copy of the photo ID. They say it's sufficient to keep a file note that a copy of a valid passport was submitted on a particular date, and that it was satisfied, it fulfilled identity requirements. And again, how many of our clients do we know that, you know, do that ID verification and retain that photo ID copy on file.
I do agree with that.
Yeah, that when I read that, what came to mind was DBS checks and, you know, retention periods around that. And what I guess we have always advised customers that pass, obviously, it's much more a sensitive information because it relates to criminal conviction data and so on. But once you do that check, all you need to keep then after that is evidence that you've done the check, not the details of the check, whether the individual has a criminal record or not. And that's what I compare it to, really. But then, like you say, for sort of verification, I don't think it's something that would really cross people's minds as much.
No, and, you know, I'm only raising it because I think there's, you know, we have to go back into our processes now and our work operational practices and decide, you know, I mean, this is Ireland, right? So this is Data Protection Commission of Ireland. So, you know, it's not the ICO saying this. It's not a case. It's not, you know, legal precedent. But, you know, it makes sense, doesn't it? You know, like all the stuff we read usually from each of the supervisory authorities, it makes sense. Yeah. You know, there's a degree of sense to it. So, you know, I'm only raising it today because it might be something that people want to go back and have a look at.
Sorry, I have been sharing my screen. I'm posting up the screen all this time, just realised.
That's all right. That's all right.
Yeah, with this, I don't know if you've ever seen the film Barbarian, but that comes to mind. It's quite a new film.
I don't think I have. No.
I'm showing your age, Jasmine.
It's a good film. I recommend it. A little horror. But yeah, anyway. Just it relates to Airbnb and it being double books. And yeah, I recommend it.
I've got something to add now. I know Phil's had a lot of the thunder today, but did you see that the ICO and the CMA released a joint paper on the expectations of firms that are using online choice architecture? So this relates to the cookie banners that we've spoken about before.
There's quite a few points.
I don't know if you've seen it, but they identified, I think there was five things where they expect better practice. One of them was called harmful nudges and sludge. Harmful nudges and sludge. I'll go through them in a set, but we'll just run through a bit of the thing.
I looked at that and I thought, what is online choice architecture? So I'm glad you spelled that out for me. Thank you.
Yes. Well, I do have, I've got a definition of it somewhere. I took it from the paper. If you bear with me 2 seconds.
Well, I will do, because on a kind of related note, I read an article today that said that the consent management industry, which is a kind of a sub branch of privacy tech, is going to be worth £2 billion by the end of the decade. So, you know, you know, you go on and you get tick for this and tick for that and, you know, cookies and that. So it's currently worth £500 million, and they reckon it's going to massively explode because of all the governments around the world that are introducing regulations similar to the GDPR that's requiring cookie consent management. So yes, Joe, have you found where you are? Sorry,
The way that information is presented and choices are structured plays an important role in shaping consumers' decision making and behavior online. We refer to this as online choice architecture in this paper. So that was what was stated at the top of the paper, and it's about 42 pages, and I'll summarize it. I don't know if we've got time to go through each one. But harmful nudges and sludge, also called dark nudges, are when a firm makes it easy or nudges the user to make inadvertent or ill-considered decisions. These decisions can also be encouraged by creating excessive or unjustified friction or sludge. That makes it difficult for the user to get what they want or to do as they wish. When harmful nudge or sludge techniques are used, consumers may make choices that they wouldn't otherwise have made and that do not align with their best interests or preferences. For example, it could lead consumers to select privacy-enhancing choices when personalising their privacy settings, or make it hard to change their privacy settings. So the example, they have quite a few examples within the paper, but the one for this one was the cookies and not having a reject all as well as an allow all, because they stated that it infringed. I think it infringed quite a few things.
You've got different coloured buttons and different size buttons, and sometimes it's confusing to know what you've got set where.
Yeah,
and having that second tab of legitimate interest, you say reject all, is that just reject all consent, or is that also reject all legitimate interest? The whole thing is unnecessarily murky, I think, or sludgy. Mm.
Yes.
And if you make it that difficult, they may as well just have an accept all button and close. Not that I recommend that.
Sounds like you do.
Well, it'll make my life easier than unticking it all and then pressing accept anyway because it's green.
I took a screenshot of someone's consent notice the other day, which you just reminded me about, in order to complain about it. And I will find it on my phone later and complain about it like you intended to. But there was a big, you know, national retailer, and I thought, you know, why have you got a non-compliant privacy statement? Bizarre. Anyway, Joe, yeah. Sorry, carry on. That was a nudge and sludge.
Yeah, so that was it for nudge and sludge. And then they had one called confirm shaming, which refers to the practice of pressuring or shaming someone into doing something by making them feel guilty or embarrassed for not doing it. This can be done by language that clearly suggests there is a good and bad choice, and in more extreme cases, that the user is morally wrong or socially unacceptable for not taking a particular action. For example, confirm shaming can be used in pop-ups that ask a user to provide their email address in exchange for a discount. A firm may offer a discount in exchange for providing their email address and phone number so they can be used to send the user direct marketing. To decline this, the user must click a button that says, for example, nah, I hate savings. Whilst the UK GDPR does not prevent firms from offering users incentives to share their personal data or agree to its processing, using language similar to that described above to put pressure on users to do so is likely to infringe the fairness principle in Article 5.1a of the UK GDPR. Consent obtained in this manner is unlikely to be freely given and therefore likely to be invalid, essentially.
Do you think this extends to accept recommended settings? I mean, that's slightly different, isn't it? Not...
Well, if you bear me a second, one of them is default settings was one of the five. I guess that's what you're on about, is it? The default settings?
No, you have a choice. It says accept recommended settings or customize settings. You know, but accept recommended settings is going to be consent to everything, isn't it? And legitimate interests, probably, you know.
I think that would relate more to the nudge and sludge.
Right.
You know, ushering them in that direction.
Yeah. Confirm shaming. I've not heard that phrase before, Joe.
No, I've not heard of many of these, to be honest. And another one was called bias framing. Are you familiar with bias framing?
I think so, yeah.
This refers to the practice of presenting choices in a way that emphasizes the supposed benefits or positive outcomes of a particular option in order to make it more appealing to the user. So it's known as positive framing. It can also be used to emphasize the supposed risks or negative consequences of a particular option to discourage a user from selecting it.
Yeah, which is, you do get that, don't you? Like, framing. You're going to miss out on all this stuff, you know, if you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the example they used was a firm's website asking users if they're willing to share their search history in the following way, by saying, by sharing your search history with us, we can tailor our services specifically to your needs, so you get the information you need exactly when you need
it.
Whereas obviously they're not telling them what you know, the cons of sharing your search history is with an organization. Obviously it depends on what you've been searching on, but it's not the best idea, I wouldn't have said. One of the other things highlighted was bundled consent. I won't go into that because I'm sure we're all aware of what bundled consent is. And then they had one called default settings, which is when designing default settings, firms apply a predefined choice that the user must take active steps to change. This can include default settings, including privacy or security features, default choices, such as automatically selected add-ons or pre-tick boxes, default brands, like the browsers or other apps that come pre-installed with electronic devices, or automatic renewal of subscriptions by default. Default settings reduce user friction, which may align with user preferences, but can also be used strategically by firms to reduce the ability of users to make effective choices. A user can be dissuaded from changing the default settings because they need to dig deeper into a service settings to make adjustments, or even need to contact the service via a different means. So, yeah, they were the things that they highlighted as things that they expect organisations to keep tabs on moving forward.
Have you got a link to that? Is that, if anybody's interested? That's 42 pages condensed into 3 minutes, Joe. Thank you.
Yes. Sorry for rambling on there, but it was quite a task to condense it down. But
I bet it was.
I can absolutely find it and pop it in the chat. I don't know if I have a link for it, but I can... Can I put a PDF in the...
No idea. I've got a soapbox thing here going on. I was boiling mad earlier in the day. I was doing some research for this, and I found this article. It says, why UK-based companies are at a crossroads with GDPR. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll have a quick look at that. And it starts, I'm going to read it out. It says, data privacy regulation, GDPR, has been in force for 5 years, but it will soon be superseded by UK GDPR. The Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, now wending its way through Parliament, will see organisations move to a UK equivalent following the country's withdrawal from the EU. But what will the change mean in practice? And I thought, in fact, I had to sign up to the thing just to comment that it was all completely wrong. The UK GDPR has been enforced since Brexit. It's nothing to do with the PDI bill.
It sounds like they've would you say they've confirmed Chenyu or something like that into giving them their email address in order to respond to something that was inaccurate?
I don't know. Maybe that's nudging or something me into responding. But I mean, you know, we're going to probably talk about AI. I wanted to talk about AI, didn't you, Jasmine? But, you know, if you've got all this stuff out there and half of it's wrong, I mean, how is AI meant to plot its way through what's wrong? Yeah. Why are people writing this stuff that's so wrong? Anyway,
where is, you know, the article writer or the organizer, the website based? Is it?
It's called
a US
BetaNews.com.
Company or is it actually?
No, it's called BetaNews.com. I don't know. I'd have to go back onto it and have a look.
Yeah.
I left my comments and then got on, let my blood pressure settle down and got on with my day.
That's one of the things I usually look towards. You know, when you see misinformation in articles, is who wrote it, where they're from, and I feel like it's usually a US organization that's, you know, that's getting involved in the UK legislation or trying to, at least.
Yeah.
Frankie's just asked in the chat before we move on, has the Digital Information Bill got through Parliament yet?
No.
It's looking more like next year now.
I'm not sure it'll get through. You know, I'm not sure I'll have parliamentary time for it.
I don't think it will. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, but
no, there's nothing to do as of yet, and there probably won't be until next year.
Yeah, I read something else quite interesting about that, because there was an article written by a law firm. I saw it on Lexology, and it was basically a question: can your DPO act as a senior responsible individual? You know, and then they've got this table of the responsibilities and the conditions around a DPO, and the same thing for an SRI, a senior responsible individual. And basically saying, no, they probably can't, you know, they can't be the same person, and various other factors like, you know, an SRI has to be, you know, a senior manager, an employee, and therefore we wouldn't be able to act as a DPO for, you know, third party. We could act as an advisor to a DPO, but that's quite interesting, though, that article.
Are they not the same thing? I got the impression from the bill that they've just renamed the name of a DPO to senior responsible individual, and they've got the same tasks. Is
similar.
It completely separate, is it?
No, it's similar. They've got similar tasks, but not all the tasks. So they don't, I think, from memory, an SRI doesn't have a designated, you know, legislated task of being involved with data protection impact assessments, for instance. It's just not mentioned in the data protection, in the DPID. So very similar. But different, you know, and the fact that they are a responsible person, you know, responsible, I think, senior manager, therefore, either non-exec or employee, presumably with some kind of executive clout, then, you know, it's different from a DPO being a specific advisor to senior management, you know, probably at a different level in the organisation. Different, but similar.
Do you have a link to that?
I do. I shall dig it out whilst you're
Chatting and get word in.
Well, I've got a little something to fill the gap unless you want to move on to AI, Jazz.
Go on.
So Katerina one of my colleagues at DPP shared a table that the European Data Protection Board created, and it was around the lawful basis for processing and the information rights that correlate to those, and kind of saying which ones apply and which ones don't. And I thought it was a really useful tool, but I've not done too much reading into it, so you may have to excuse me if I'm way out of shot here, but there was something on there that I just couldn't quite understand. So it said that the for the lawful basis of performance of a contract, the right to erasure does apply, and I couldn't work out why that would be. Are you able to, am I being really stupid, or why would you be able to erase anything, any of your personal data that was collected for the purpose of performance of a contract? I just can't wrap my head around it. I didn't look into it, I didn't read into it. Katerina just shared the table with me, so I probably should do a bit of reading, but off the top of my head.
It could be in relation to, it's not just the performance of a contract, it's, you know, entering into a contract, isn't it? So if you go through the steps of entering into a contract and then don't enter into a contract, you know, it's very similar to the Airbnb, you know, you no longer need that data, therefore you haven't got a lawful basis. Now, you might say, we want to know who we had discussions with in the past, therefore we're keeping it on that basis of performance, assessing whether to enter into a contract or not. Or I was going to say, and as Fiona's also highlighted, after the contract is over, you might want a record then. You might want to challenge that.
With the contract over, surely in line with data retention principle, that your data would not be retained beyond the contract unless it was for, well, it might be actually. Never mind. I'm gonna talk myself into a wormhole.
I think you're quite right to raise it, Joe, and it's just interesting to kind of think of use cases when it might apply. That's part and parcel of what this is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, it seems very broad in that case, because you could apply that to any lawful basis, really. You know, you can apply erasure as long as you're not legally obliged to keep it for any longer and that kind of thing. So I don't really understand, without reading further into it, what it means by that.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because I got an email from a customer yesterday. I'm just going to go through my sent items. And they were saying, Phil, we don't really understand the difference between a portability request and a subject access request. Could you explain it, please? You go back to GDPR and you pull it all out and you say, well, you know, a portability request only applies to personal data which are data subjects provided to a controller for a start. Secondly, it only applies to processing based on consent or a contract. And thirdly, it only applies to automated processing, so i.e. not structured manual records, etc. Whereas a SAR applies to all personal data. So I hope they've understood that. I gave kind of an example of a photo editing. You run a photo editing platform, people post photos to it, you want to move off your platform to a different platform, under the right to portability, it applies to help them to move the data they've provided to you, you know, and you're processing under the basis of either consent or a contract, you know, using automated means. But you know, that's probably only a subset of the data. You know, the account data, the financial transaction data wouldn't be subject to a portability request, but it would be under a SAR. So that similar kind of thing, Joe, you kind of look at a lawful basis, you think, why does that say that? And how does it apply in practice?
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting point, though. So we've got a few minutes left. I don't think we'll have a chance to talk too much about AI, but we were talking about doing a session on that at some point anyway, weren't we? So, you know, there'll be more to delve into there. But I saw in the news that regulators have published a joint statement on data scraping. So that's where my mind went into AI, and there's a lot more to talk about there. But I read that a dozen supervisory authorities have published a joint statement for collecting the protection of personal data from unlawful data scraping. So the statement was issued by the authorities of Argentina, Australia, Canada, Colombia, Hong Kong, Jersey, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Norway, Switzerland, and the UK. And it reminds organisations...
Quite an interesting
bunch. Yeah, I know. I wasn't expecting it when I read supervisory authorities. I'm not sure if that's just the terminology they've used or what, but it reminds organisations that personal data that are publicly accessible are still subject to data protection and privacy laws in most jurisdictions, and highlight the risks facing such data, including risks of social engineering or phishing attacks, identity fraud, and unwanted direct marketing or spam. And the authorities have invited relevant organisations to respond to the statement. It got me thinking. Yeah, it just got me thinking. There's more to this, but there's a lot of different types of AI out there, and that's what I wanted you to get into a little bit, Phil. One of these being, is it generated something network, GAN? Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Generative AI, and then that's what is that not what ChatGPT is?
The one I'm thinking of, let me just dig it out quickly. So it's generative adversarial networks. So it consists of two neural networks. One generates data such as images, and the other one evaluates it. So it's used for creating realistic synthetic synthetic data, such as, you know, when you see a video of, of someone singing and whatnot, it can be anything. So it can have applications in art design and data augmentation. So it got me thinking about when, you know, when you see deepfake videos of celebrities talking or singing, you'll see, I don't even know, SpongeBob SquarePants singing Candy Shop. But I was wondering if, where it is a celebrity, would that be their personal data?
That's good point. So when I'm doing it's like training in the data protection principles, and we're talking about fairness of processing, and I don't know what is personal data. You have a series of pictures that you've seen the slides.
That made me think of that with the Ronaldo shirt.
So I've got like hand drawing of the Beatles. You know, is that personal data? I've got a picture of Minnie Mouse. I know she's a fictitious character, but if she wasn't, you know, would that be personal data? You know, so it's always interesting to challenge a classroom to say, you know, well, that's obviously personal data, but, you know, let's try and tease this out and see how far we think we can kind of bend this. And, you know, what about Sergeant Pepper, just a coat, you know, is that personal data? You know, do you immediately think of Paul McCartney? You know, is it something identifiable just from that picture, not even of a face? And I think it's a really good point that you make, you know, and this is the complexity, I think, of this field, which is what is personal data. It's defined, but when you actually start thinking about it and applying it in practice, you know, Lady Gaga, you know, that's a stage name, but, you know, it's still personal data, isn't it? Or an identifier.
And this is the thing with, you know, if say, for example, deep fake videos and everything like around and amongst it becomes more widespread, popular,
what you're
more
saying
common.
What you're saying is some manufactured information that looks like it's attributed to and relates to an individual. Is that personal data relating to them?
When it's so accurately, you know, it could easily be them. Like,
it's it relates to them.
Literally be them. But
it's not them.
No, it's about them. It relates to them. But, I mean, it's linked to an artificial image of them. So, and they haven't created it, but so what? You know, half the data that's in circulation about you haven't created. You know, somebody else has created it about you. I think we should have a think about this. We need some lubrication to talk through this one over at the tannery.
It's like you say, you know, if you draw a picture of the Beatles, is that their personal data? Is this not just like similar to a drawing? It's not real.
It's interesting, but I mean, we don't necessarily have the answer in the classroom. What we're trying to do is force people to out of their comfort zone to think this stuff through, you know, the obvious stuff: name, address, telephone number, number plates, you know, national insurance number, fine, you know, but, you know, let's start pushing the boundaries. The thing about the AI, Jasmine, I have to hold my hands up and say I was asked to write an article about the way data governance frameworks are going to have to change for AI. So my first The very first thing I did was I sparked up ChatGPT and asked it the question, you know, how will data governance frameworks have to change because of AI? And it you know, it's really helpful actually in getting, you know, it was like a set of questions I was asking ChatGPT about. Well, what do you mean by this? And what do you mean by that? And well, what about this? And it's quite useful actually in practical terms for, you know, just helping to shortcut some of the thought process. And what it did do is it broke down, you know, different types of AI, which I thought was again quite interesting. So, you know, it was talking about machine learning, you know, where machines are trained to learn from data and improve their performance, you know, over time. We talked about neural networks, which are kind of computational models with interconnected nodes, and they're things like speech recognition and text to speech and natural language processing. So again, that's another application there. Natural language processing is kind of like language translations and sentiment analysis and chatbots, and, you know, again, slightly different field. Computer vision is about facial recognition and view analysis and object detection. Robotics, AI-driven robots, expert systems, you know, helping and support decision-making of humans, you know, might be used in a whole range of, including our industry, you know, a whole range of scenarios. Reinforcement learning, training machines to take a sequence of decisions and seeing which ones have got what effects. So this might be war gaming and, you know, learning optimal strategies. And then this, what you talked about, generative adversarial networks, where you and you get two neural networks and you put them against each other and you just see which one kind of wins out. And you're trying to, you know, use that for, you know, art, design. You know, you end up with newly created types of realistic synthetic data, whether it's pictures or actual, you know, data itself. But that was a fascinating exercise for me to do, just to kind of think it through and then apply it to, well, how are data governance frameworks put together now? Where they're weak, you know, how can they cope with this kind of stuff? And it was just interesting. But we haven't got time today to talk about that for you.
No, on that point though, when I was reading that, I've never really comprehended or thought about the fact that there's so many different types of AI. Like, I know that it can do different things. You know, you've got ChatGPT and then the deep fake things and whatnot, but there's so many different kinds. And it made me think, say with this EU AI Act, I don't know if that takes, I've not read it through and through, you know, the drafts or whatever, but does it take into consideration these different types of AI and how they function? Or is it kind of one size fits all, you know, approach? Is that really, you know, wise?
Yeah, I have to say, I haven't read it. I don't know if you have, Joe.
No, afraid not.
I do remember it going off, a risk-based approach. So, you know, there's different levels depending on what its purpose is for. But I don't know if that takes into consideration the different approaches to AI as a whole. I don't know.
I would have thought, we'll have to read it, I would have thought it would take a fairly high non-prescriptive approach. What I kind of thought in the end was, you know, data governance frameworks are going to have to evolve. You know, I haven't seen yet an AI policy, but, you know, one would think you'd need to have an AI policy. But, the problem is that how many steps away of AI systems, you know, battling each other, you know, to try and get supremacy? And, you know, what's the fallout for not just humans, but all the flora and fauna on the planet? You know, I think that there are some real, you know, concerns about it, and I think the realist, you know, should be concerns about it.
Yeah, definitely. You know, Fiona's said in the chat, has anyone seen the AI film on Netflix called Tim? So TIM. She said terrible ending, but worth a watch around the threats of AI in the home.
No,
I've not seen it, but I've heard about it. So yeah, I will give it a watch.
I haven't seen it, but also if you want to learn something on AI, Mo Gowdat did a podcast with Stephen Bartlett. It's on YouTube. It's about AI. I've not listened to that either. But it's about like the threats of AI, so I might have to give that a go before
we have
a session on it.
Yeah, Diary of a CEO. I watched one with someone who used to work really high up in Google. I don't know if you've seen it, Joe. Oh, right, yeah.
He's done two.
I think, yeah, I've seen the first one. And he's written a book on it, I think, and the threats of AI. And he used to work in a really innovative, creative space in Google. Yeah. And it's one of his biggest concerns, like it is or was with, you know, at one point with Elon Musk. And is it Steve Jobs as well that warned against it?
Probably.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I'd have thought so.
Enough influential people.
Anyway, we've run out of time, I'm afraid. So what have we got on next week? Next week, Friday.
Yes,
your PCI special.
Yeah, we've got Kenny on our QSA. One of our QSAs.
Does that mean Jasmine get a week off?
I don't know. You can, but welcome to join in and kind of talk through. But I mean, I want you know to try and, you know, she's got a fantastic background. You know, she worked a lot in financial services. She's competent in GDPR, ISO 27001, PCI DSS. So I think hopefully we'll have a really interesting conversation. I'm going to talk a bit about the changes in her concepts on the thoughts on the changes in version 4, which, you know, coming out thick and fast. So that's next Friday. What are you doing next week? I've got a week. I'm in the office, I think, 3 days. But, you know, I keep bleating on about my PCI exam. I have to do that before the end of the month. So I have scheduled Thursday to actually knuckle down and do my annual exam.
The end of the month that was yesterday?
No, I've got till the 12th of October to get my do my requalification. I mean, I like this structure because you have to do an exam. You have to go through structured training, which is all online, and an exam every year. And I think I wouldn't say that would be a bad thing for a DPO to have to do.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
What you got on next week? Go on, sorry, I was interrupting you.
No, I'm working full time for one of our customers still. So I'll be just doing what they expected me to do, I guess. But I am actually in the office on Monday for the first time in about a month. So I'm actually very excited for that to see all the faces that I've been missing. So, yeah, if anyone on here is for DPP, come into the office on Monday and you'll get to see me.
Yeah, I've not thought about next week yet. I'm thinking about the weekend, so.
Good response. Well, listen, we've run out of time. It's been quite an interesting session, actually. I think we've covered a lot of ground on the news. It's a GDPR radio session. So I hope that was some interest and some food for thought. Hopefully. Maybe not. Not much on the chat today, but that's either everyone's switched off or thinking it
everyone's
through.
Everyone's ready for the weekend, aren't they?
I think you're right, yeah. Anyway, thank you very much, Joe, for putting your lunch hour aside. I thought you might be having a sandwich while we talk, but thank you very much for putting your lunch time aside.
Get it in a sec.
Really, all appreciate it.
If anyone hasn't received an email from Miles as well, for subscribers about welcome packs, we're issuing out welcome packs that includes just a few little bits from DPP, including like a pen, privacy cover, things like that. Just drop in him an email as well, and we'll send one of them through to you. But yeah, thank you.